Thanks. We've been working our way step by step through one crisis after another on the computer, but we'll see how it goes. The gallery here inside here is full of stories, but of course none are more dramatic or even more multilinear and multimedial than that of ELO itself, now progressing through its third year, funded in part by the Ford and hopefully Rockefeller Foundations and supported here at UCLA by Kate Hales and her associates. Its origins go back to a quiet but eventful supper in London when Jeff Ballou, ever the visionary, suggested he'd like to help find the funding for a conference of e-literati and technology developers. This led to the TP21CL TechLit Symposium at Brown in the spring of 99, and a young e-writer at that event, Scott Retberg, in and around sending the gathered rolling in the aisles with his and his co-authors' boisterous performances of the unknown, expressed his desire to help create an organization to promote and assist electronic literature around the world. Jeff nobly took this project on too, and between the two of them and all the other talent they could corral and put to work, ELO was created, launching its website just over 2 years ago in sync with the launching of the new millennium. The two of them have worked tirelessly and selflessly through many ups and downs, including those of our economy, to bring us here today, a quite spectacular achievement for which we owe them both, together with our wise and skillful hostess, Kate Hales, who has given us a home, an enormous debt of gratitude. ELIT, too, has come a long ways. It's less than a decade ago that I was able to persuade the New York Times Book Review to let me review every known published hypertext fiction in the world, something I predicted would only be possible that year in the way that reviewing every book in print might have been possible 3 or 4 years after the invention of the Gutenberg press, but never thereafter. Even so, I proved a meager prophet, for I hadn't foreseen the internet explosion which would happen within 24 months and make my little augury look pale indeed. There's now a vast worldwide community of electronic authors and far too many works for anyone to be able to experience them all, much less speak intelligently about them. Our gallery curators, Los Glazier, Nick Montfort, and Noah Waldrop Fruin, all award-winning web artists themselves, are to be congratulated for the very high quality of the work selected from this vast mass of digital creativity. In the tale of our hero that follows, I've mainly avoided these pieces and those of our performers and readers insofar as they are all available to us here, though I may refer to a few of them in passing, more by way of illustration than in judgment. But I apologize to all of you in advance. Has no memory of ever being attached. This was his plight, for when last seen, our much-traveled, multi-gendered hero, le mot, la palabra, das Wort, had, in the venerable tradition of fairy tale heroes, who prefer always the active over the passive and the common over the proper, Our hero, as I say, had left the protective covers of home and set out bravely into the wide, uncharted world of hyperspace. Or was it cyberspace? Who knows? Only he could say, after all, having, as it were, the wherewithal to do so, unsure of herself, though it was out here. Where, separated from so many familiar lifelong companions, all the rich, deep-structured communities in which he'd lived and, at least on paper, prospered, she found itself alone and vulnerable, adrift in an immeasurable and lawless extension and set upon by predatory media monsters, voracious as Pac-Man, perfectly able to dismember him, chew her up, and spit it out. Just a bump on the top, I think. Hit the top. Adventure, yes, but of some danger to our hero's health, as most of his word doctors gravely forewarned their patient's very substance at risk in this parasitic realm, where she found itself often sucked dry as if by vampire's kisses, reduced to a mere floating husk, buffeted by flash and cacophony. He was often lost and reviled and obliged to travel incognito as a kind of noise or color, a mere cog at best in a so-called text machine. At this point, Zara Safavian's Dissolution was to arrive on our screen from the Poems That Go website, which is down, the server down. The idea here was that there's a bunch of little squares out of which text flows, pictures, out of which text pops, and you can put sentences together. And the last one we were going to hit on was one that said, like dog shit steaming hot. And yes, which is how the word felt often, like dog shit steaming hot, or maybe not so hot, but desiccated and cold and blue, living a life more like an afterlife. She missed being stroked and fondled, lovingly sniffed, taken to bed and beach, and felt more script on than text on, or is the past tense more scrapped on than tacked on? What did it know in this grammarless, dimensionless expanse? He suffered from a rash of electronic hotspots and narratological bloat and combinatorial textonema, a kind of enervating cancer. She was plunged defenselessly into motion graphics, a polite way of referring to ABC sickness, which, if the ergodic damn truth be told, was an IFing pain in the arse, S's and T's. It felt alienated and underappreciated. There were communicative gaps he could not leap, and she was treated as a second-class citizen in its own Motown. Motown spelled M-O-T-T-O-W-N. Motown was a hot center now, full of neon exuberance and the big beat, unsuitable for reflection or contemplation, for which the word still felt a great longing. And he took to hanging out in slummy motels at the edges of Mudvilles, where she still had a certain whorish single-syllabic appeal. But our hero, of course, was born and bred a rambling person, whether first, second, third, single, plural, or indefinite, and is nothing if not resilient, a power to be reckoned with even when marginalized, the only player in this game able adequately to express itself, and so needed by all other hyper-warlords in the end, even more than he needs them, as witness the current intrusion of text in the film, much in the manner, as one might say, of barbarians adopting the culture of the very civilization they've overrun. And, as ever, she has loyal friends in remote by-corners and pockets of this new universe, where hospitality can always be found, not excluding our own little university in that damp, misty node of Providence, a city said to be more of the imagination than of the real, there and not there like the data on your screens, with, as John Hawkes liked to say, its rusty iron winters, but also with its relative freedom from the buzz and hype and aggressive cupidity of the hotter, harder spots that surround it. There, the word still counts. It was at Brown where hypertext pioneers Michael Joyce, Stuart Moulthrop, Jane Yellowlees Douglas, Nancy Kaplan, John McDade, Jim Rosenberg, and others found an early audience, and where the work of such young media artists as Bobby Arellano, Shelley Jackson, Mark America, Mary Kim Arnold, Jay Dillamith, Matt Derby, Judd Morrissey, and innumerable others was fostered, and in the case of Noah Wardrop Fruin, is being fostered. One of the highlights of this symposium is the presentation of Judd Morrissey's and Laurie Talley's exquisitely beautiful, densely complex, and elegantly designed My Name is Captain Captain, being published this month by Eastgate Systems. Mark tells me that although it's not on the table out there, mail orders will be accepted. It's a dead reckoning metaphor apt for this night flight into electronic space, literature that is new, yet as we've always shown it. I'd love to take you through this in detail, but I think Judd is going to do that for us in one of our readings. Of course, sound and graphics, still and animated, are part of the mix, part of the text, as the post-Barthian fashion would have it. Our hypertext fiction workshops evolved long ago into electronic composition courses, but the word is still privileged, for in our perversely archaic love of storytelling and poetry, we cherish still the peculiar qualities of our restless little hero, its intimacy, his subtlety, her vast expressive range, and through its very transparency, his power to stimulate thought and imagination, and then to reflect upon what she has done. It's true that the whole world is a text to be read, but it's also true that written literary text, standing alone on the tablet, the parchment, the page, the screen, is a unique and wondrous thing, nor so fragile as one might fear. Here's a more or less traditional hypertext work in progress by Brown student Andy Vanell, using the familiar structural metaphor of architecture to deliver pages of text. I was watching it. We started with a character from the. Let's go back to the. Go back there. And we'll pick it up again. There are, as you can see, all of these little nodes in this mall are story materials. And in this case, on this information thing, you poor thing already lost and just entered the arcade. And it mentions in this one that you'll notice the flaneurs here walk turtles on leashes from time to time. We find this a charming touch. The main character through this is a kind of flaneur, and going to another part of the... We find here he'd been working on a physiognomy of the typical cell phone user, etc. He's trying to act like a flaneur. He opened his well-worn copy of Flaneuring for Dummies to search for a precedent, but quickly began scanning the book for instances of his name. Of course, there was nothing. He enters the mail area and encounters in the mail substation the hideous briefcase man, who's another character that we can follow in the text. And then We'll go back here. When he reaches this particular room, he notices nothing unusual in obituaries today. Check the rest of the newspaper for any mention of his name. Scroll down to the bottom of that one, Bobby. Let's scroll down to the bottom. And after going through all of this text, he says basically there was nothing going on in this in the month. It was a quiet and uninteresting day. And he's now in the store for ladies' undergarments. Oh, well, had to happen sooner or later. He stepped gingerly across the floor in case there was a trap door somewhere for the unsuspecting males who wandered in. There was a rose-like smell and the hush of many lacy things rubbing against many other lacy things, like a breeze blowing through a perverted garden. He suddenly felt his gender as if it were a car alarm. This was no good. In one smooth motion, he removed the gun from his breast pocket and fired it into the air. All heads turned. His gender was a fire alarm now. He grabbed the nearest woman by the waist, made all the necessary motions to suggest he was kidnapping her. His motions were interpreted correctly. The women of the store began to make the necessary motions to suggest they were frightened, but nevertheless willing to sacrifice one of their own for the greater good. His hostage squealed and elbowed his ribs, but he managed to pull her matronly body out of the store. In the atrium, he could hear the distant footsteps of mall security. He told the woman she was free to go, but for good measure added, that still didn't mean he wore ladies' undergarments. The word has also refound its voice, bringing together, after a long separation, the oral and written traditions, as in this work in progress by Brown Sr. Courtney Rowe.
Matches in my pocket says wanted meaningful overnight relationship. And cigarettes definitely taste different when you light them with matches than with lighters. The first drag is a sort of harsh, rough, charred taste in the back of your throat. So tonight's topic ought to be highlights from the porn party that we just threw, but I don't really want to disclose names, and I'm not really sure what specifically would be counted a highlight, although my wool jacket is still soaking wet from a long walk in the rain, and I was told at some point, I think this morning, that my hair still smelled of whipped cream and most likely other people's sweat and saliva. But no highlights from that are going to get online because I don't want to disclose names. So instead, I am going to talk about my latest obsession, which is, this is so ridiculous, but it's boys. Boys, they're great. And anyone who knows me and knows the sort of sexual preference flea circus I've been going through for the past couple of years will be very amused and annoyed at me for having been saying for so long that the next one's going to be a girl and always having the next one be a boy. But really, boys, they're great. They're just adorable. I'm completely enamored with the idea of boys. Not men, not males, just boys. And I'm not quite sure what the distinction is, but there definitely is one. I mean, boys, they have hair in fascinating places, and their chins are rough, and sometimes they bite, and that's just adorable, and they smell, but it's good, and they're strong, and they got these bumpy, muscly things, and sometimes they're self-conscious about their bodies, too, which is just so incredibly endearing, I can't even describe it. And they make fun of how little I eat, and they have penises that they pay complete and absolute utter attention to, and sometimes they snore when they sleep, and that is adorable. Yeah, it's obviously an obsession. I have no idea where it comes from. I know, I'm just thinking because, you know, when I was having an obsession with girls and their softness and all that stuff, I kept ending up with boys. Maybe now that I'm enamored with boys, I'll start ending up with girls. Either way, I just think boys are great. So, anybody knows any nice boys, just send them over my way, and I'll just be like, hi.
One reason I wanted to pass through Courtney's site is this notion that all of these pieces are very short, but all of them somehow interlink with one another. We're going to get blink up. Brown Jr. Joe Winters composed a piece which combines kinetic text with playable sync sound, somewhat like those you saw in Jim Andrews' Neo at the beginning of the Go ahead, touch it. You always did back me into a corner, which is where I seem to find myself lately. A hold up in flesh, pressed together at right angles. We also spell very well at Brown. It's still loading, Bobby. Seems to be. If it doesn't load, we'll jump past it. There we go. So, face like sandpaper, elbows like rounded stone, skin like lighted firecrackers, ankles like firewood, wrists like candlesticks, pockets that jingle, jaws that creak, the rings that rotate. The punchline of two guys walking into a bar holding hands. A dream of tasting bacon. On armpits provoked by February air, I remember most your sweat, good to me. These red lines now are calling up musical elements that can all be conjoined or listened to singly, with text that reads a third or fourth or fifth nipple, an unfortunate haircut, friendly fantasies, a misplaced innuendo. The places where you won't admit it tickles. There's some text right in the middle there. Pull up the middle ones. A head voice even above that. Discuss the politish 95% of sexuality. And as Bobby keeps them alive, the music keeps playing, and then as they fade, the music goes away. Well, there are several pieces like that out there now, many more sophisticated than our undergraduate exercises, where text, sound, movement, and interactivity all seek to support one another in a complete lyrical or narrative whole. Here's an example coming up of an enhanced package from addressed in skinc.co ode by Marianne Breeze, alias Mez, which we saw a bit of earlier today, with its inventive Mezangel language system, which reminded me on first encounter of that great verbal wit from the last century, Crazy Cat. So these are enhanced texts and will enhance sequence. And as we do, it'll call up, once it's loaded, it'll call up lines when we pass over the keyboard. And as we hit on those, we'll get, again, like Joe Winter's piece. Mez has collaborated on occasion with Talon Mehmet, who shares her enthusiasm for elaborate punning and inventive programming. I think we hit Skyscratches as an example, just call up the headshot of it. Skip all prelims. Mehmet's work is quite recognizable, and no other hypertexts out there, if we can still call them hypertexts, look quite like his, and though each individual work is relatively short and seemingly self-contained, they actually interlink in many ways, above all, thematically, creating a larger ongoing opus of which they are each a part of a still developing whole, a vision of a sort forming itself. His titles read almost more like chapter or scene titles from a longer work, delimited meshings, reasoned metagoria, encephalopedia, novelex, translucidity, delivery, machines toward electricity, lexia to perplexia, and his puns are fun. Note how he turns next into both exit and no exit, and everywhere he sees the sign, as is in his notorious pseudonym we saw on the screen earlier today, cyber organizations and its discontents by sign.mud fraud. There are narratives and characters, some of which appear from work to work, Lolly and the sophomore, to name but two, but these traditional elements soon disappear into an embracing project of self-reflection and examination, the self here being more that of the form itself rather than that of the author. It is as though Mehmet is seeking to think as the machine thinks, his intricate and elegant designs, precise and classical, being a way for that character, that ghost in the box or beyond it, to dress itself up for spectators. Structurally, I would describe Mehmet's work as primarily theatrical. He brings our hero, immaculately costumed, on stage where he can strut her stuff, engage in rhetorical display, surprise the audience with various turns and tricks, then make, often with a deathly suddenness, its exit. In A Machicolated Body, which is an account of a kind of dinner date with a virtual partner, eyed through a screen, or a real dinner date seen as such, he speaks of circuses and operas, festivals and plays. The actors exit, enter in repetition, pushing each other from a spot at center stage. You see, from the bleachers, it appears that the struggle for the spot, center stage, is where all the action is. The screen is a hole, an opening, an eyepiece. And as I look across the table, I no longer see the face of my guest. What I see is more mysterious, accidental, the purely pixelated topology of sacred elemental space. In Lolly's apartment, which he describes as an experiment in the ruination of context and the reconstruction of this ruin, or the gathering of its fragments, the stage is a maze built on part of the floor plan of the Gnosis Labyrinth, and in particular, the space of the snake goddess sanctuary. Though it's easy to get lost in here, we're going to try, if Bobby can get the script, we will try to follow Ariadne's thread and reach a piece of the story involving an imposter professor named Fred Nietzsche. So we begin the excavation. No, we've already lost our place, Bobby. The thread broke. Okay, top screen. Now we're going to begin the excavation. That's it. Off we go. Now hit notebook. Now the door to the left. Now to the far right. That's where we're going. Now you can roll over that figure. On the floor, I found these sheets of paper. Where Frederick thought he'd seen a woman, we find only words. So here we are in the story of Fred Nietzsche. As we click on each of the blue highlighted places, I think I hear my name, Lolly calling me, etc. It's all right, move on, and so on. This is where I think, no, it's not yet where sophomore comes in. Now we just click and move the story forward step by step. So here's a genuine narrative sitting in the middle of this labyrinth and following a variety of interesting ways. We end up here with ambush, which you can... I am certain I am in danger, and now click again, and now we will have... No, now go to the dot, go to the circle, that's it. And now we can click on this song and move the song along by itself. This vision of the electronic writing medium, you can go ahead and move on to the next piece, as an imaginative theatrical space where the word itself might be the top banana, is, for me, one of the most promising and intriguing aspects of Mehmet's art, useful for everyone. And here in his Lux Bronzino 1540, all the way down, exposure, that's you go. We find ourselves literally, or at least virtually, on stage, but in a manner only possible in this medium. From the balcony.
Swing with me, O fragmento nard, grand and glorious, puncturator of the scene.
What is that you'd like to see, mademoiselle? You have not given me enough.
Seems you prefer the leash. You may do as you like, you will the scene, the next you are my pilot.
Choice and chance to please or proffer.
Please, my dear Duchamp, why do you resist me? We are the actors of a combined fate, agents of extremity. Do not waste my time.
I have no fear of excess. Evermore, evermore.
Then swing with me, O bronze boy. Do as you've always done. Fill the room with eyes, two by two, to witness.
I can see right through you.
The director exits.
You asked for it.
Please proceed. Let the play begin.
Oops.
There we go. They'll be there in a moment. So the characters arrive. Hit on the figure itself, she'll come forward, the angel figure. Anyway, we can play with this for a while. At some point, I thought already we would have the text on the screen that says, in the balcony, she begins to pay attention. Her neck is bent, then straight, and bent, then straight. This structural metaphor of the theater also draws attention to an aspect of electronic writing that is too pervasive to be ignored, its essential brevity. Our hero, adjusting to his new environs, has so far chosen, if in fact she was ever free to choose, to be spare and concise, seeking a concentration of content, a full filling of the sign, demonstrating the while that while there might be, that what might be lost in stamina can be gained in inventive versatility. The complex, sustained, page-turning novel form created by book technology does not fare well here, as so many have complained. But it does not fare well in the theater either, where but a walking shadow each poor player struts his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more, and a good thing too. We don't take the theater to bed with us, but we are no less affected and enriched by it than by books. What does read well in this medium is the short, compact, multi-layered hypermedia work, such as most of those we've looked at so far, or as, for example, this piece by Comnino Zervos, who uses a collage of photos and text reminiscent of our own family photo albums to recall his childhood in Richmond. Is it loading?
I remember my childhood being vexed in the grit and the smell and the bat. Where I lived in a fish shop with my mother and father, together to feast on the shop's throwaways. And spent the rest of his life we kids as a slave to a stone. And the times he got mad, the rest of shit out, drunk out his slaves and our watch on rich man's shoulders. He was the trays of rosemary and boyhood. In the fish on a crime, my mum had paid off his down to the fish shop. And my mother had paid off his down to the fish shop. And my mother had paid off his down to the fish shop. And my mother had paid off his down to the fish shop. And my dad had paid off his down to the fish shop. And my dad had paid off his down to the fish shop. And my dad had paid off his down to the fish shop. And my dad had paid off his down to the fish shop. And my dad had
Or Lisa Bloomfield's trilogy on show in our gallery with its three taut narratives of survival, two of which combine magic lantern-like film frames and photographs cropped from mass media with fictional text in a manner reminiscent of the novels of the late W.G. Sebald, the third minifiction about a killer bear making innovative use of a trail map. That's right, they can see this one in the thing. When longer narratives are launched, the more successful ones usually take their lead from the likes of the early hypertext classic, Its Name Was Penelope by Judy Malloy, or the Net's first ever interactive novel, Bobby Arellano's Sunshine 69, or the picaresque multi-linked hypernarrative, The Unknown by Scott Retberg, Frank Markert, Dirk Stratton, and William Gillespie, providing short, linked segments on a compelling and singular theme. The most spectacularly successful recent example being Caitlin Fisher's ELO award-winning These Waves of Girls, from which we'll enjoy a reading later tonight, I believe. It's a kind of fictionalized memoir of childhood, blending short narrative texts, photographs, artwork, sound, and voiceover in a seamless mix that invites a sustained engagement even while avoiding a sustained plot. Picked one route of amongst many because of its integration of graphic and I think we missed the links, Bobby. There's word links, not arrow links. That's all right. Oh, you're on your way. At night, the fireflies come out. They make me squirm. So beautiful at night, so terrible and haunting the morning after. The jar in my bedroom back home in the city, I catch them dozens at a time. We can turn them on. I think if you scroll around them, they'll come on and off. You can click out of that now. Memory, voiceover, artwork, and old photographs also form an important part of Mysteries and Desire, Searching the Worlds of John Retchie, written and produced here in L.A. a couple of years ago by Marcia Kinder with the help of the author as part of the Labyrinth Project of the Annenberg Center for Communications at USC, in which our hero, wearing Retchie's voice, goes cruising, hits the confessional box in the back alley, more or less at the same time, pumps iron, and wanders through memory-stirring photos and souvenirs of boyhood with a voiceover provided by the writer himself. I think we'll pass through this, Bobby, and get on to the final. The author's voice providing substantial proof that a symbiosis between competing media, including something like virtual reality, can be achieved into moving and entertaining effect. Much that exists, this piece, it did use virtual reality. I have had a reason for moving in this direction, as you'll see in a moment. Much that exists in print literature, it's true, does not yet translate well into this electronic medium, but personal memoirs, are they any better in print? No, they certainly are not. Our award-winning poet, John Cayley, from whom we'll hear in tonight's big show, also used QTVR to surround us with the whispery, melancholic intertwining of three lives in London under St. Paul's clock, what we will. Here, as so often in these examples, the word enters not as text, but by way of voice over. and go to 16. Things now hit the screen itself should move it. 20 seconds, that's too long. This has text that's being read over by the voices on the three persons, but you can move and see the voices. No, move at the bottom one, move the bottom main screen, move the main screen around. And I think they're here in duplicate, so the kind of surreal quality of the piece where the people in the memory of the people in the memory of the moment are here at the same time.
I could ask, where are you now?
You could. Not here.
Not here.
Wherever now has no meaning. Wherever now has passed or is still to come. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
When are you here, I cannot ask.
Keep going.
It makes no sense.
Keep going.
You can never be here.
There's the man character sitting there.
I live here in this city. But I'm never
here. But I'm never here when you are.
Hit on 50 instead of 60, but that's all right. And I click behind that screen. And if you double click on the screen itself, never mind. Well, anyway, here we are, the climax. Our hero's a tough character. Tell him she can't go somewhere, and before you can say encephalopedia, it will be there. Brown's Center for Advanced Scientific Computation and Visualization, known best as the CAVE, is, as its homepage says, an 8-foot cubicle in which high-resolution stereo graphics are projected onto three walls and the floor to create an immersive virtual reality experience. Special hardware and software keep track of the positions and movements of a person entering that environment, changing the images in the way in the cave in a way that allows the visitor to feel wholly immersed in the virtual space. It is, in short, a wow experience. But it was built by scientists, for scientists, namely those of applied math, chemistry, cog sci, computer science, geology, and physics, and any intrusion by creative types was strictly scowled upon. Maybe they were afraid we'd kick holes in their screen or mark them up with graffiti. Or maybe even virtual graffiti frightened them, for you'll note there is no mention anywhere in their project descriptions of the word. It's not so much that the word was a no-no, for even that word was not there. Not even as voiceover, the sound equipment was simple stereo, and it was turned off. Moreover, almost all projects were of static spaces or objects to be explored. Narrative movement was unknown. So we proposed, in effect, a scientific project. We would introduce the word, both as visual text and as voiceover, augment the sound potential, and using our decade of experience in hypertext, construct sophisticated narrative movements to complement the spatial ones presently in use. We found interested allies in the computer science department, including the developers of the R-Cave and cave painting projects, and eventually gained admittance. As you'll see, we made some use of the cave painting tool, turning it into a writing tool, and we've learned a lot from the modeling techniques of the R-Cave project. There's an insightful reminder to be gleaned from this project. Brown University excavations of the Great Temple at Petra Jordan began in 1993, a time, as you'll recall, before Windows, before the internet explosion, and before all the hypermedia that followed thereupon. But the professor and her staff decided from the outset to record all data digitally, even to the use of digital theodolites to register the surface of the site from week to week. It was not clear how this digital data might be used, but it seemed important a decade ago to do this. So when caves came along and one arrived at Brown, all that data was suddenly available for this quite impressive project, reminding us yet again that we cannot predict the circumstances of our future reading. We may yet take the digital world to bed with us. Of course, when I was able at last to announce the course, every other student at Brown wanted in there. Finally, I was able to select a team of about 17 or 18 skilled electronic writers and composers, designers and visual artists, theater people, programmers, mostly highly talented undergraduates, though including a handful of key graduate students, such as Noah. And about 8 weeks ago, we hauled on our gear and went spelunking into this luminous, but until that moment, wordless domain. None of us had ever been in here before as other than spectators, so we set as our midterm target the creation of a set of simple narrative tools to be developed individually or in groups. The startup was slow and at moments discouraging. So much had to be learned. The coding was difficult. Promising ideas that took a lot of time to make did not work or seemed to have no practical application. But then about 4 weeks ago, the first truly successful projects suddenly popped up in our magical playhouse. One student was able to make a short film clip run in the cave, and another, working with a gifted programmer, was able to construct her image of a floating box of text with the letters running backwards, such that to read it, it was necessary to pull the box on over you and read it from the inside. Things have been booming since then. The movie character has led to the startup of a large narrative involving a cocktail party, which in its playful open-endedness will remind some of our old hypertext hotel of a decade ago, while the word box and all similar ideas have been followed, have inspired the making of a mini-anthology of text-in-space pieces. There was a Blue Room shoot scheduled at the Rhode Island School of Design this morning, and all the students in the class will also now be characters at the party. Some of the weirder student apartments in town will provide texture mapping for the walls, 3D modelers are furnishing the rooms, and students from all the writing classes at Brown are being invited to submit texts and ideas for the mini-anthology or for party dialogue. The film you'll see was shot by students in class, including Wednesday afternoon's workshop, and quickly edited night before last, and yesterday morning for this Brown Goes to Hollywood event. I picked up the film on the way to the airport and have not yet seen it myself, though I'd worked on it the night before. The early part will suggest devices to be used for the larger narrative. The second half will offer glimpses of the text-in-space projects. We plan to push on through the summer and next fall to see how far we can go with these two central ideas, expecting all the while that others will arise. Alas, I can't provide you the genuine experience of being inside the cave, only a dim reflection. You'll have to listen to the responses of those inside to get some sense of the impact. So here we go, our hero's newest adventures in Motown.
This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door.
I have only square tapeness to the exact day. Ruin the... These are all that I need.
So the idea here was a narrative idea that we have in hypertext, which is you click on a certain node or something. It doesn't have to be a location. It could be John Kisses Meredith or something like that, and you click on that and it comes up.
And so the whole idea is a 3D menu that you suddenly become immersed in.
The narrative device I'm experimenting with is different sort of cinematic or borrowed from cinema transitions that then hopefully can be taken somewhere else. And we're just going to see essentially a tracking shot that moves us through the space, and then we can move within it by walking around the space. What differentiates this from other sort of virtual reality experiences is that you do retain your body and your ability to move around, which I think does make it a more compelling experience in becoming a sort of disembodied head.
To walk up and approach someone.
I was attending a lecture earlier about women, drugs, and so-called premenstrual dysphoric disorder when I saw, I think, your sister and the pathologizing therein.
So when you get close, they greet you with some sound file that you have, and then you have here this. They pop up some choices, and you can select among them using the wand. So I can select one of these.
Well, friend, I sure know your sister.
So you get another sound clip, and then the movie plays a little bit, and then you get some new choices, so.
Oh, stop. I quite clearly remember that birthmark. Sweet as honey. That explains the taste. I was told not to answer that.
The other thing you can do is when you back away from them.
I'd sleep with you in a second.
They say something in the manner of goodbye.
So what I wanted to create was a sort of a narrative of ideas floating around your head, and it's sort of changed from what I've originally had. So we have, you see the pointer here, and as we push the button, we see a text come out and encircle it. Eventually, what's going to happen is. Text from this, I think we were talking about maybe actually having it peel off the wall and start circling you. After that is I'm going to start recording and getting some audio, and then basically what I'm going to take words out of people's things and then have that flying around your head, and I guess the whole narrative is sort of escaping thoughts, I suppose.
That's now to start painting. Move the brush around and create a 3D stroke. The third button on here is kind of the grab metaphor that someone was asking about earlier. You can just reach the brush up here, hold it down, now you're grabbing what you've already painted, and you can move around wherever you want.
The purpose, my intention in this was to have the person actually be able to create the text. This button here does say letter for letter, so I'll do the letter for letter one first.
Okay.
The middle one does paints.
Uh-huh.
And the one on the right selects. And you know that you've selected it when it's sort of cutting through it.
You could take a letter.
And you can sort of, after you've written something, you've got a bunch of letters, and you can actually create or construct your own text.
When you start with this one, it kind of has like a loop, the beginning of Space Oddity.
From the second part of the song. And you have to get inside.
That's
the box.
You have to get inside to read it.
To read it. Tease candy ferns who wink at mushroomed midgets to tickle bubble pebble piles with filmy fungi digits. It's more difficult to read.
Whoa.
Okie doke.
Okay, kind of feels sick.
So this is another form of navigation that we've been experimenting with, where we have three boxes on the table.
So, let's say you can grab one and bring it over and put it on the table. And now you're inside a fish tank. Instead of
we got to pull that one just quietly on our guests. We'll just step in here and do that, shall we?
That's unreal.
Zoom back up. And select the next one. Put it on the table.
It's just there, Street, and like, we haven't got that Matrix thing, and you got like text floating down all around you.
These are actually images of text. So I'm backing up a little bit, and we're still in the beginning space. It's actually quite a large space.
And you can still see the table and the other cubes that are waiting for.
Hey,
what's
the door?
Yeah, kind of.
And you can put the last one on.
Oh man. Oh, that's great. It's really good.
That's gorgeous.
So basically.
The film was put together after midnight by Dave Shaw and Michel Ego on that list. They've dropped the sound out of this part of it, which is quite funny. I don't know, maybe they've given us two cuts. As I say, this is really rough. I just picked it up before I came here. Some of the fun of this cut was some of the comment going on while the love stuff was floating around everybody's heads. There's people under all of that movement. I think the last one was maybe it's still there. No, the last one is an expression of, oh, wow, like I'm just getting a little bit nauseous.
What are you guys doing with these cameras? I mean, you're just recording?
We're making a document of the course so that at the end of the semester we'll have some idea what we did and what order and be able to share the documentation with others.
That was Michelle's signature at the end. That's it. Thank you very much.